Thank you. I should come here more often, if only because people at Temple Emmanuel never clap when I'm introduced. And it is nice to be back, not only from the perspective of my participation in the monthly interfaith dialogue, which has now been hosted here for, I'm going to guess, 3 or 4 years running. They're wonderful groups altogether. But over the years, I've been invited to speak here, I want to say, about a half dozen times on Sunday mornings. You should know that Laird Stewart and I grew up in North Jersey. Our high schools were bitter high school rivals. Far worse than Mount Lebanon and Upper St. Clair. When we played, not Jewish geography, as we Jews call it, but North Jersey geography, we both had a chuckle about the enmity that existed between our two high schools. It was pretty awful when everything is said and done. And now I'm happy to say I've got a wonderful friendship with Reverend Jim Gilchrist and Alice, my wife, also with Gwen. So here I am. Perhaps my most memorable Sunday morning here, at least as I understood for members of the church, was one Sunday morning I came and I did a program of Jewish music. I play the guitar. I sing. You seemed very receptive that Sunday morning. And it turned out that later that morning I had to officiate at a wedding. So this was, I want to say, in the Reagan 80s. So naturally, for the wedding, I was wearing a tuxedo. Well, for years thereafter, I'd see people at the Village, I'd see people at Giant Eagle, wherever it might be, and they'd say, oh, I was there that morning that you wore the tuxedo to church. So I've had any number of wonderful experiences, memorable experiences here at Westminster Church, and I trust this morning is going to be one of those wonderful experiences. My subject, indeed, is Jesus the Jew. Now, that said, the pressure is on me. I acknowledge for many different reasons. One is I gave this presentation years ago when Mel Gibson made his movie, The Passion of the Christ, and there was concern across the Jewish community nationwide that it would unleash a tide of anti-Semitism. So, to give reassurance to my congregation, I gave this presentation so that they might have some insight into the depth of the relationship between Judaism and Christianity, and that when everything is said and done, not to worry. One of the attendants was Dr. Eberhard von Waldo. I don't know if his name is familiar to some or many of you. He taught at the Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. His son and daughter-in-law and grandchildren were then members of Temple Emmanuel. And yes, I recognized him seated in the congregation that evening. When I concluded, he raised his hand and he said, "This is the best presentation on the subject of Jesus the Jew that I've ever heard, given by a rabbi." So he didn't say it was the only one he's ever heard, but then, and this is why I mentioned this in particular, he then said, "But you can't speak about this subject through the eyes of Christian faith." And he's correct. So please understand if my presentation has this qualification. I'm going to offer to you what I believe are insights on who Jesus was, and there should be no question in anyone's mind that Jesus lived and died as a Jew. So what I'm going to offer to you is Judaism in Jesus' day and how I understand, on the basis of my, if I may, extensive research over the course of the decades that I've been a rabbi, how I understand the Jew that he was. Now, before going any farther, or is it further? I know it's further, but I'd like to offer a prayer because this is a prayer for the study of Torah, and we're going to study Torah both in the particular and in the literal sense. And by the way, does everyone have a handout? Good. Okay. So the prayer I'll offer is for the study of Torah in the particular sense and in the generic sense, and I'll offer it first in Hebrew and then in English. Baruch atah Adonai, Eloheinu melech haolam, asher Kitshanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu la'asok b'divrei Torah. Blessed are you, Lord our God, ruler of the universe, who makes us holy through your commandments and commands us to study the words of Torah. And if you'd like to make this blessing your own, you can do so simply by saying the word, Amen, which comes from the Hebrew lahamin, meaning to believe, affirming that what was just said, you too believe in. All right, so the story begins more or less 90 before the Common Era, when Rome entered the picture in Judea, as Rome would call the Jewish nation, consequent to the Battle of Panium. Judea then became a vassal nation of Rome. It was, suffice to say, a very unhappy relationship. The Jews didn't like being ruled by Rome, and the Romans found the Jews a particularly unruly subject. That said, things went from bad to worse, so that as we come to the turn of the Common Era, Caligula, emperor in Rome, crucifies some 2,000 Jews in and around Jerusalem. So this is to suggest that Jesus was one of many Jews, in fact, who were crucified by Rome. As a further indignity, by the way, the Romans left the corpses rotting on the crosses and subject to the, if you will, vagaries of nature, the buzzards and such, the vultures. Jewish tradition has a concept called Kibbud HaMeit, honoring the dead. More to be said about that with Jesus' death, that you should bury your loved one as quickly as possible and as safely as possible. So again, allowing these corpses to be exposed to the elements, if you will, was intended to be a further insult to the Jews. Things are, again, moving from bad to worse. The great Jewish thinkers of the day you are familiar with, and unfortunately, your introduction to them casts them in the most negative of all lights. But I'm going to go out on a limb, as I have any number of times over the years in presenting this in churches, and say, in truth, they are the great heroes not only of Judaism, but I would propose Christianity as well. More to be said about that. They are, anyone want to take a stab at who they might be? The Pharisees, okay? They were the great Jewish religious and political thinkers of the day. They saw the suffering of the Jewish people. Remember, we are considered God's Am Segula, God's treasured people. It doesn't mean that we're better than any other people on the face of the earth. It doesn't mean that God loves us to the exclusion of all other peoples. It does mean that we have this special covenantal relationship with God, that God has given to us in total 613 commandments, each affirming God's presence here on earth. So how to reconcile the idea that we are God's treasured people with the suffering that we were enduring at the hands of the Romans? What the Pharisees proposed was, we may be suffering in this world, but by faithful observance of the commandments, we can anticipate life in God's, as they called it, Olam Haba, the world to come. Now, when I say world to come to you, I suspect that you envision a heavenly afterlife. What the Pharisees intended was life here on earth, God's reign of peace here on earth. We're living in this world, but we are soon to transform, by dint of our faithful observance of the commandments, into God's reign of peace on earth, the world to come. They believed that this world to come would be championed, heralded by an individual, a descendant of King David, to whom they gave the title Mashiach. Mashiach. Mashiach means anointed, a sign of election or selection. Now, one of the handouts I gave you has passages from the Torah that use that term. Exodus 25, thanks. You have it. I don't. Good. So you'll hold it up for me. No, that's all right. You'll hold it up for me. Exodus 25 refers to the anointed priest or the anointing oil, which, oh, great. Thank you. There we go. The Shemen HaMishchah, the anointing oil that was used to consecrate Aaron and his sons, Aaron as high priest and his sons as priests. Yes? So, Shemen oil HaMishchah. Leviticus 4 refers to HaKohen HaMashiach, the anointed priest, again a sign of election or selection. Okay? Then, 1 Samuel chapter 24, references made to David, earlier Saul, by the way. These are David's words regarding King Saul. David refers to him, Saul, as God's anointed, God's Mashiach. Now, what the Pharisees did was to take this title, this term Mashiach, and endow it in one individual in particular, a descendant of the Jewish religious, political, and military leader par excellence, numero uno, and that would be David. Right, okay. There was no notion whatsoever, as the Pharisees coined this term, of the Mashiach being God incarnate. Okay? That's Christianity. Okay. Again, a military, political, and religious leader who would overthrow Roman rule of Judea, overthrow Rome altogether, and establish God's reign of peace here on earth, fulfilling the visions of the ancient prophets, when we will live happily ever after, for however long, hard to know, according to the prophet Daniel, which is a very abstruse book in the Bible. Maybe we're going to live for 10,000 years and then evolve into the purely spiritual beings that we quintessentially are. Hard to know. Be that as it may. Great. Did it infuse comfort and inspiration in a suffering people? Yes. They believed that the Mashiach was coming tomorrow, at the latest next week. Now, you know this title, Mashiach, in English as? Exactly. Okay. Again, no notion whatsoever of God incarnate, no more than God is incarnate in each and every one of us. However, there's a particular problem with this whole ideology. The way I like to present it is as follows. What about my Aunt Tilly? My Aunt Tilly was kind and righteous. She faithfully observed every one of the 613 commandments that devolved on her. And by the way, it's the nature of the 613 commandments, the constitution that the Jewish people followed at this time, that not every person was obligated to keep every commandment. For example, from Deuteronomy it says that the king shall not amass horses and chariots unto himself. So that would apply, well, and today it would apply, if you will, to Donald Trump, all right, but not to the rest of us. Yes, you understand what I'm saying. Okay. Time to move on, yes? Okay. Now, Aunt Tilly lived in Bethlehem. 3 months ago, Aunt Tilly wanted to come visit us in Jerusalem. How many of you have been to Israel? Well, gotten good. So you were at both Bethlehem and Jerusalem. Maybe 5 miles between the two. Distance is not that great. Politics are extremely complicated between the two. All right. She was coming to visit us when she was accosted, raped, and murdered by Roman soldiers, a common event of the time. Now, you mean to tell me that Aunt Tilly's not going to make it to God's reign of peace here on earth? If ever anyone lived who deserved that reward, it was Aunt Tilly. And if you're telling me she's not going to live in God's reign of peace here on earth, then I'm going to say to you, this is not fair. The God who promised this is not fair. You understand the theological issue, okay? Well, again, the Pharisees delve into this problem. And here's what they propose. In the one supernatural task that they assign to the Mashiach, again, flesh and blood, after the Mashiach overthrows Roman rule of Judea, overthrows Rome altogether, and establishes God's reign of peace on earth, the Mashiach will go from grave to grave of all the righteous who ever lived. Who are the righteous? The Jews who keep the 613 commandments and the non-Jews who keep the seven commandments of Noah. Let me see if I can name them. You have to recognize the one God. You can't blaspheme God. You can't steal. You can't murder. You can't commit any kind of sexual impropriety. You can't eat the limb of a living animal, and you have to establish courts of law to oversee the other six commandments. In other words, as we would say in Jewish, if you're a mensch, if you're a decent human being, you too merit God's ultimate reward of life here and God's reign of peace on earth. I will add, Judaism has never believed that there's only one religion for the world. Time permitting, there's more to be said about that. Judaism has always believed that there's only one God, and there's a world of difference between the two. So, what gave credence to this claim now by the Pharisees? Well, passages from the prophets, for example, Isaiah, "Those who sleep in the dust shall live again." And, among other passages, Ezekiel 37. You've got it in your hands. Okay. Who would like to read? Yeah, the acoustics are great in here. I trust everyone can hear me. Yeah, but, yeah, don't be. Yes, someone please.
I'll read it.
Thank you. Stop. The original Hebrew is Ben-Adam. Ben-Adam, son of man. A common colloquial expression in Ezekiel's day. Okay? Equally so, here is a concept that the Pharisees introduced, a revolutionary concept. They describe God as our Father in heaven. Okay, wait. That, in turn, would make us God's children. All right? So, who then becomes son of God, for example?
Messiah.
And? Yeah, exactly. If God is our Father in heaven, we are God's children here on earth. This, too, was a common colloquial expression, son of God, daughter of God, if you will, in the time of the Pharisees, that they're introducing now, more or less at the turn of the Common Era. Okay? Now, I'm going to recite good Pharisaic theology that should be familiar to you. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done. Everything I've discussed so far are examples of this prayer, yes? Give us this day our daily bread. We're physical beings, God, and forgive us our trespasses. We're imperfect. We sin. We hurt each other. And forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us, and so on and so forth. This is a good Pharisaic prayer. Please continue.
Prophesy over these bones and say to them, O dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. Thus said the Lord God to these bones, I will cause breath to enter you, and you shall live again. I will lay sinews upon you and cover you with flesh and form skin over you. And I will put breath into you, and you shall live again. And you shall know that I am the Lord.
Keep going.
That they may live again. I prophesied as he commanded me, light and stood up on their feet, a vast multitude. And he said to me, O mortal, these bones are the whole house of Israel. They say, our bones are dried up. Our hope is gone. We are doomed. Prophesy, therefore, and say to them, thus says the Lord God, I am going to open your graves and lift you out of the graves, O my people, and bring you to the land of Israel. You shall know, O my people, that I am the Lord. Where I have opened your graves and lifted you out of your graves, I will put breath into you, and you shall live again. And I will set you upon your own soil. Then you shall know that I, the Lord, have spoken, and I have acted, declared the Lord.
Great. Thank you very much. The meaning should be clear enough. That said, traditional commentary on this notes that Ezekiel was the one prophet who prophesied Chutz La'aretz, outside the land of Israel, in the Babylonian exile. And therefore, his prophetic visions are the most, if you will, bizarre. Okay, modern biblical scholars propose that Ezekiel may have been schizophrenic. But let's take it at face value. This is one of the passages from the prophets that the Pharisees would cite as giving evidence to one of three, the first of three Jewish principles, which I call the potential for life never ending. Something different than life after death. Okay? So, again, the Mashiach, after he overthrows Rome altogether, will go from grave to grave of all the righteous who ever lived and raise them from the grave in fulfillment, among other prophetic visions, of this vision by Ezekiel. Okay. Did this answer the question of Antilles' awful death before the coming of the Mashiach? It did. Okay. God willing, if you're interested, I'll be happy to come back another time and discuss the other two dimensions in detail, all three. For now, resurrection. By the way, happy Easter, right? Two, belief in reincarnation. Yes, it's been part of Judaism. And three, the potential for the immortality of the soul. Okay, but let's focus on the subject at hand. We turn now to messianism, yes, which I would maintain is the most powerful idea, certainly in Western history and probably world history altogether, surely in American history. You know that the early settlers here in the United States believed they were coming to the Promised Land. Yes. And even in modernity, Jewish messianism has entered American politics in very profound and real ways. The New Deal, LBJ's Great Society, JFK's The New Frontier. Clinton in 92, this is Clinton number one, Bill. The Democratic platform emerging from that convention was called the New Covenant. New Covenant, okay? You can't get more religious than that. New Covenant in Latin is Novum Testamentum, or more familiar to you is New Testament. Yes? Okay. And I would say that when Donald Trump stood at the Republican National Convention last summer and said, I alone can accomplish this, he was pulling on the heartstrings of American messianism. Okay? Whether or not he is open to discussion, but that's not our topic this morning. So we turn now to the following. Again, there's rampant messianic expectation. People believe that the Mashiach was coming tomorrow at the latest next week. Now, we come to the person of Jesus. But first let me say that Jesus is one of several individuals who either they themselves claim to be the Mashiach, or others acclaim them to be the Mashiach. He was probably the one least well known in his own day. In 66 of the Common Era, Eliezer ben Yair led a revolt against Rome, and he was initially successful. Many people hailed him as the Mashiach. He was defeated. He sought refuge at Masada as Rome crushed the revolt in 70. And in 73, he and about 900 followers on top of Masada, a fortress down by the Red Sea, committed suicide. Better to die as free people than live on as slaves to Rome. 132, Shimon bar Kokhba leads another revolt against Rome. He, too, initially is successful. His revolt, too, is crushed. He's executed by Rome. So much for them being the Mashiach. David Ruvaini, a Sephardic Jew, had an audience with the Pope in the 1500s. He was invited to meet with the Pope because there was broad acceptance of the fact that he may be the Mashiach. And then finally, born in 1626, Shabbatai Tzvi, in 1665, said he would begin his messianic reign in June of 1666. All those sixes don't amount to a hill of beans in Jewish tradition, but all those sixes in Christian tradition mean a lot. Yes? The book of Revelation? Yes, the Antichrist would have the number 666 emblazoned on his forehead. And I'll remind you that 1666 is in the immediate aftermath of the 30 Years' War, the sectarian struggle between nascent Protestantism and the Catholic Church. It's a bloodbath. Not only many Jews, but many Christians were all set to accept the idea that Shabbatai Tzvi was the Mashiach. In fact, he was forced to convert to Islam. Maybe another day, if we have time, we can go into all these things, be that as it may. So where do we begin the life of Jesus? Well, if you do a Wikipedia on Jesus, or better, anyone other than Jesus, what's the first thing you're going to come across? Or in a good old encyclopedia. By the way, I'll share this with you. I just tore apart so I could recycle our Encyclopedia Americana, dated to 1953. Yeah, thank you, thank you. People younger than we are couldn't relate to that. It was painful. Yeah, you know, you had to tear off the leather covers, and yeah, and it was also really heavy for the garbage men, be that as it may. So where typically would a person's biography begin? What's the first fact that would be offered?
Born.
Date of birth. Okay. That's not the case with Jesus. Now, I understand how this might be more of a theological question for Catholicism. Okay? But nonetheless, it's out there in our culture. So let me deal with it. Isaiah 7. There it is. Okay? And by the way, let me explain the following. His name in Aramaic, which was the lingua franca of the Jewish people, and that part of the Mediterranean altogether, his name was Yeshu. When Jews for Jesus have their ads in Time magazine and so on and so forth around Christmas, they render his name Yeshua. Yeshua means salvation. Yehoshua is the name you would know from the Torah, Joshua, connected to Hoshua, again meaning salvation. But again, Yeshua in Aramaic means salvation, and you'd no more name your kid Yeshua then than you'd name your kid salvation today. Yes? It was a pet form, Yeshu, like Josh for Joshua. Okay? So Isaiah 7:14. Assuredly, my Lord will give you a sign of his own accord. Look, the young woman, I've underlined it. The word in the original Hebrew is the Alma, is with child and about to give birth to a son. Let her name him Emmanuel. Okay, the young woman, Alma. Alma is found elsewhere in the Bible. Nowhere else does it mean virgin. If the Bible wants to call a woman a virgin, it will use one of two expressions, one the word betula, virgin, or isha shelo yada'a ish, the idiom, a woman who has not known a man, and that's in the carnal sense. Okay? So, from the context of Jewish tradition, the Bible, the Hebrew Bible, this word means young woman. Interesting. In the Septuagint, which was the first translation of the Bible from the Hebrew into ancient Greek, it's rendered as Parthenos. Should ring a bell. Parthenon. Yes? Parthenos means young woman. For example, the women who served in the Parthenon in Athens were young women. Okay? Now, yes, some Greek mystery cults were served by young women who were temple prostitutes, who would engage with the worshipers who would come in sex. Now, as I like to quip, maybe that would increase attendance at Shabbat services. But it's not Jewish. It's not Jewish. I don't think it's Christian either. I'm just making a joke. These women were called Parthenos too. Okay? Yes, the virgins who served the goddess Vesta were also Parthenos. But my point is, Parthenos means young woman. Alma means young woman too. Okay. So much for the notion of, as it's called in Catholic theology, virgin birth. And here is a confusion in terms that I've found over the years. Immaculate conception and virgin birth. Immaculate conception refers to the conception of Mary, who, like she herself, her mother was impregnated by God. But the difference is Mary was a virgin when God impregnated her so that she would give birth to Jesus. Okay, so much for that. Where was he born? Well, you tell me. Bethlehem. Well, there is conflict internal to the Gospels in the New Testament about his birthplace. Mark chapter 6, verse 1. And by the way, here you go. It's all right there. Okay? Now, an aside. People today turn these into PowerPoint presentations. The U.S. military did studies and came to the conclusion that PowerPoint presentations are not an effective means of teaching. So this is a good old handout. Okay? Yeah. And, you know, keep an eye on this. If I'm missing something, raise your hand and say, Mark, what about this? You skipped it. Okay? You can take this home. I can remember I distributed this once to begin a presentation at Temple Emmanuel, and someone said, oh, you don't remember what you want to talk about. You need your notes. And I said, no, it's not about me remembering. It's about you remembering. Okay? So there you go. Okay. So here we go. Mark chapter 6, verse 1 refers to Jesus of Nazareth. Okay, Mark and John consistently refer to Jesus of Nazareth. Matthew and Luke go to great lengths to trace Jesus' birth to Bethlehem. They tell the story that because the Roman procurator, Pontius Pilate, declared a census, every Jewish male was obligated to come to Jerusalem. So Joseph and Mary, she's 9 months pregnant, schlepped down from Nazareth, and it's a good 75 miles. They get to Jerusalem and discover that all the Motel 6s are booked. So they go to the suburbs, they go to Bethlehem, same story there. They end up in a barn, and she gives birth in the barn and places the baby in a manger. Okay? A long, intricate story. Why would Matthew and Luke go to such great lengths to place Jesus' birth in Bethlehem? Well, guess who was born in Bethlehem? David, exactly. So by placing Jesus' birth in Bethlehem, it gives credence to the claim that Jesus was the Mashiach. However, more likely he was born in Nazareth. Nazareth was a hotbed of foment against Rome at this time. And I'll remind you, the depictions of Jesus' crucifixion, okay, Often have a plaque above his head on the cross, I-N-R-I, in Latin, standing for Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. Okay, so he's probably born in Nazareth. Probably born in the year 2 or 3 before the Common Era. We know in the adjustment from the Julian to the Gregorian calendars, things got shifted a little bit, okay? We know very little about his life until he's around the age of 30, 32 or so, and then we know a lot. One, we know the honorific title that his students, his disciples, called him. Rabbi, meaning my teacher. Again, merely an honorific title at this time. We know some of the things he taught. Matthew 5:17. Think not that I am come to destroy the law and the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. The law was the Torah. The prophets, we've discussed, at least in part, Ezekiel and Isaiah, plus all the other prophets. By his own words in New Testament, he was a faithful Jew. Now, he taught more. He taught the coming of the Mashiach. He taught the coming of God's reign of peace here on earth. He engaged in a very popular Jewish ritual of the day in anticipation of the coming of the Mashiach. He went to another Jew named Yochanan HaMatbil, Yochanan the Immerser, and in a symbolically representing spiritual purification, readiness, Yochanan HaMatbil immersed him in water. Okay, Tevilah is the ritual in Hebrew. Or, as you know, this individual in English, in Christian tradition, John the Baptist, and the ritual in Christian tradition is baptism. Okay. He taught belief better. He demonstrated belief in the resurrection of the dead with the resurrection of Lazarus, which, by the way, mimicked the resurrection of the boy of the Shunammite woman, as I recall, who died, and Elisha the prophet goes into his room, gets on top of him, and lays his body on the boy's body. The boy's body is warmed, and the boy is brought back to life. Okay. By the way, I didn't say this before, but it should be obvious. The underlying principle is that God is so powerful that God can even overcome death. And there's a passage in Torah, I give life, no, I deal death and I give life. And because of this syntax, according to Jewish tradition, it gives all the more credence that God indeed can give life to the dead. Now, it's hard to believe, isn't it, by the way, as long as I'm here. The rabbis said about this belief, one who denies the principle of the resurrection of the dead will not be resurrected from the dead. Mm-hmm. It was their way of trying to compel belief in a totally, as you and I would call it today, illogical and unbelievable notion. Okay? So, here's the thing that's going to get Jesus in big trouble. He taught that God is our Father in heaven. God, in fact, is the King of the universe, as we express in our prayers, Melech HaOlam, King of the universe. Why is that going to get him in trouble? Sedition. Against? In the eyes of Rome, there is only one ruler in the Roman Empire, and that is Caesar. Okay. The spring of that year, let's call it 30, Jesus, like every Jewish male, is obligated to come to Jerusalem for the Passover pilgrimage. 3 times each year, every Jewish male, Passover, Shavuot, and Sukkot, in the spring, early summer, and early fall, was obligated to make pilgrimage to bring his offering as worship of God to the temple. By the way, there's an episode when he arrives of him turning over the money exchangers. Yeah? What are the money exchangers doing there? Simple enough. Judaism is now in the midst of an age of great proselytism. There are Jews across the Roman Empire. They didn't have El Al Airlines or Delta then, or Alitalia or whatever, that you could easily get from Rome, for example, to Jerusalem. So what Jews living in, well, across the Roman Empire did was send tribute in whatever monetary measure they might have to Jerusalem. And then these tables, these coin exchangers, would then turn them into shekels so that sacrifices could be bought in worship of God. Okay, now, he celebrates what's called the Last Supper. I would love to tell you that the Last Supper was a Passover Seder. And it is a popular belief today that indeed it was. I can't tell you that. It is an idiosyncrasy of the Jewish calendar that Passover never begins on a Thursday night. And I've discussed this with Christian clergy. I want to make sure I've got the events all in order. You know, yeah, the Last Supper was Thursday night. Okay. Oh, well, so much for that. Now, he's arrested that night for sedition. He's brought before Caiaphas. Caiaphas was the high priest. One of the inaccuracies in Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ is he represents Caiaphas as a Pharisee. No way. He was a Sadducee. Okay? To call Caiaphas Pharisee is like saying Barack Obama is all set to go to work for Breitbart. Yeah? It's not going to happen. All right. The New Testament also describes Caiaphas as in charge, as involved in the Sanhedrin. Now, here we go. There was no Sanhedrin in Jesus' day. When Rome crushes the revolt in 70, one Jew, Yochanan ben Zakkai, takes his disciples out of destroyed Jerusalem to Yavne, a little town closer to the Mediterranean. And there, he establishes what ultimately would be called the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin is running the show when Christianity emerges from Judaism. Now, who were the first Christians, or better, who were the first people who believed that Jesus was the Messiah? Jews, exactly. How do you think my friend and colleague, Reverend Gilchrist, would feel if, I assume there are Peters Township members here at Westminster, if all the Peters Township members said, Upper St. Clair is too far. We're going to now create our own church down the road in Peters. We don't like schlepping here. Do you think Reverend Gilchrist and the leaders of the church would say shalom and good luck? Or do you think they'd be a little chagrined? You get my point? This is exactly the dynamic going on between the Sanhedrin and nascent Christianity emerging from Judaism. Okay? There's hostility. There's resentment. Now, how does it play itself out in the pages of the New Testament? Well, who takes it on the chin in particular? The Pharisees. The Pharisees, by this time, had taken on a new and now official title, the rabbis. They're now the rabbis. The rabbis of the Sanhedrin are complaining about the Minim, as they were called, the heretics who are leaving Judaism. And the heretics now, in creating their own new religion, want to ascribe blame in what they felt might be an historical way. They couldn't blame the rabbis because there were no rabbis as an official position. Remember, I described Jesus and his title rabbi as honorific. They knew that they couldn't blame the rabbis for crucifying Jesus. So they blamed their predecessors, the Pharisees. Now, I haven't said this yet, in an earlier context. Let me say it now. Everything Jesus taught was Pharisaic. And the reason he's going to die is for teaching those Pharisaic teachings. By the way, the most famous of all Pharisees arguably was Hillel, who was asked, what is the essence of the law? He said, what is hateful to you, do not do to others. The rest is commentary. Go and study. This should sound an awful like the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Their speculation will never know that Jesus may have studied. He would have been a boy. He may have studied with Hillel. We don't know, but we surely can be confident that Hillel's teaching impacted Jesus profoundly. Okay. He's arrested. Ostensibly brought to Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin. No. Solomon Zeitlin, a 20th century Jewish historian, a Jewish historian on this epoch in Jewish history, the turn of the Common Era, Tanaitic history as we call it, does believe that there was a group called the Sanhedrin. They were the friends of Caiaphas the high priest, and they were all retainers of Rome. The high priest by this point in time was designated by Rome. Okay, so they were all Roman lackeys, if you will. Even at that, Caiaphas says, sorry, this is a political charge, not a religious charge. I have no authority here. Take him off to Pontius Pilate. During the inquest, Pilate said to him, are you not king of the Jews? Jesus replies, so you say. Who in Jesus' mind would be the king of the Jews? God, exactly. Okay. So Pontius Pilate then contrives the following. He condemns him to death, but he gathers the townspeople of Jerusalem together. And now here we are. Turn the outline over. Here are two aspects of anti-Semitism that emerge from the New Testament. Before I go further, I want to say the following. This is evidence of Roman anti-Semitism. Okay? And also the following. As I understand it, Jesus' brother, I've had this conversation with Reverend Gilchrist, sought conversion among the Jews to the new religion. Yes? James? Yeah? Another Jew, Saul of Tarsus, sought conversion to Judaism among the Gentiles. James gave up. Saul, then Paul, was successful. Where would he find converts to this new religion? Among citizens of the Roman Empire. How appealing would it be to them to say, oh, by the way, you killed our Messiah? Mm-hmm. So they're going to ascribe guilt to the Jewish people. All right? So here again, I think we see evidence of Roman anti-Semitism. So, Matthew 27. Pilate gathers together all the people of Jerusalem. Who should I set free? There in verse 17. Barabbas or Jesus, which is called Christ, meaning Messiah. Okay? That's a loaded question. If they're going to say, set free Jesus, it's like saying he's our Messiah. It's like saying we don't acknowledge Caesar as our ruler. And as surely as Jesus is about to be crucified for denying Caesar as his ruler, affirming God as the only ruler, they would suffer the same fate. And by the way, when everything is said and done, at the end of the first revolt, Rome had killed about one-third of all Jews in the world, which is exactly what Adolf Hitler accomplished with the Holocaust. So Rome could do it. It's a loaded question. So as the story is told. Okay, and then... Yeah, there we go, 27:25 with the arrow. Then answered all the people and said, "His blood be on us and on our children." So here, anti-Semitic principle number one. We are guilty in the death of Jesus. Okay? Number two. It's from John 44. 8:44. "Ye are of your father the devil, and the lusts of your father ye will do. He was a murderer from the beginning and abode not in the truth, because there is no truth in him. When he speaketh a lie, he speaketh of his own, for he is a liar and the father of it." All right? So here now, how could we possibly kill the Messiah? Well, we are the children of the devil. Okay. So two pillars of anti-Semitism now are set in stone in the New Testament. Suffice to say that the Jews suffered mightily over the course of the centuries because of this. More to be said about this. Jesus is condemned to die on the cross. For those of you who went to Israel, did you walk the Via Dolorosa? Yeah. It's amazing. It's amazing. By the way, Jerusalem, as beautiful as it is the world's most conquered city. And every time it's been conquered, it's been rebuilt on the rubble. So that the Via Dolorosa today, in fact, stands about 20 feet above the path that Jesus would have walked carrying his cross to Golgotha. There are different stations of the cross, as they're called, where different events happened. At one point, Jesus stumbles and writes himself against the wall. And today, you come to that station and you can see a hand imprint in the wall. I'd love to tell you it's from religious pilgrims over the course of the centuries wearing away the stone, but no, someone actually chiseled it in, and there it is. The final stations of the cross are all housed in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. I trust you went there too. Everybody, you gotta go there. It's an incredible place. I've been there many times. I'm going to be there, yes, God willing, in a few weeks. I don't know that I'll have. I had an epiphany there. Imagine that. Anyway, Golgotha is in the church. You walk in the main entrance, a side door as it is, and there's a worn flight of steps leading up to an upper room. I always would have thought Golgotha is at least as high as Mount Washington. No, it's maybe as high. It's not even as high as the ceiling. Okay? There's a Greek Orthodox shrine on one side, there's a Roman Catholic shrine on the other. There's an altar on both sides. The Greek Orthodox area is much more elaborate than the Roman Catholic. You can kneel down under the altar and you can stick your hand in a plate down to the crack in the rock where ostensibly the cross was placed. You go downstairs, you see Golgotha from the side, and there's a crack. Yes? A bolt of lightning struck when Jesus died, but let's get to his crucifixion first. They've done experiments. Your palms are not good enough to hold the weight of your body. The nails likely went into the wrists. You do know the way you die when you are crucified is you suffocate. Your arms come out of the shoulder sockets. You tear all your intercostal muscles. You can't pick up your ribs to breathe, and you suffocate. It's an awful way to die. Painful and awful. Nailed to the cross at noon. Dies at 3. He's a young man. He's 33 years old. He suffers a premature death. He's a carpenter. He doesn't have a grave. Jewish tradition is you bury your loved one as quickly as possible. They don't have enough time before Shabbat to do this. So Joseph of Arimathea, a wealthy Jerusalem merchant, offers them his family, his tomb temporarily. so that they can come back on Sunday, retrieve his body, and bury his body permanently. That's what they do. Mary, Mary Magdalene, some others, come back Sunday morning, and what do they discover? He's gone. He's risen. Okay. Now, everything about Jesus' life, and even in the claim that he was resurrected from the dead, again, is from the Pharisees. I have a book in my library called Jesus the Pharisee. I know this is a big adjustment in terms of mindset, okay? But again, what I'm offering to you is a Jewish perspective on this, okay? Without the Pharisees, we wouldn't have Judaism today. I would say without the Pharisees, we wouldn't have Christianity today. I like to believe that Christianity, if I may, is Judaism for Gentiles, part one. Judaism for Gentiles, part two, I believe, is Islam. Judaism was every bit as influential on the founding of Islam as it was on Christianity. Surely, the Catholic Church has been at the forefront, by the way, of advocating this recognition. And listen, the fact that I, a rabbi, could speak to you on a Sunday morning in a church indicates how deep this understanding goes, and to which I have to say, thank God. So, a couple of things to wrap up as quickly as I can. And by the way, I'm so sorry. I originally committed to do two sessions with you, and two sessions we could really delve into the subject. But I discovered I have a conflict next Sunday, so oh well. But a couple of things to wrap up. It's Palm Sunday, 1996, and I'm in Jerusalem, part of an interfaith mission from Pittsburgh. And we go to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and I'm standing outside the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea while there are services going on throughout the church. That area of the church is under the auspices of the Armenian Orthodox. Over there are the Greek Orthodox. Over there, Roman Catholic. In another room in back of the tomb are the Egyptian Coptics. All these different services are going on simultaneously. And just for good measure, on the roof is an Ethiopian Coptic monastery. They think they're the real proprietors of the church. They've got the key. So every afternoon they lock the church up and they go back up on the roof. And every morning they come back down with the key and they let these other groups in. So here I am standing outside the Church of the Holy, the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea with all these services going on. And I'm standing with Father Dan Valentine, who used to be down Route 51. Lovely guy. And Edie Navet, a member of my congregation, and then the director of the Holocaust Center of Greater Pittsburgh. So this service is going on in, what language do Armenians speak? Is it Turkish? Is it Armenian? I don't know. But it's a language I don't understand. And there's the Greek service going on over here. I don't know that either. The Latin Rite. And the incense is burning, and my head starts spinning. And I said to Dan and to Edie, God must love this. Yeah. What makes us think that God can and should be worshipped in only one way? To me, it's to God's magnificence that God can be worshipped in many ways. And I used to teach at Seton LaSalle High School, and I used to say to the kids at this moment, if you say the Our Father, that's what Catholics call the Lord's Prayer, yes? If you say the Our Father, and she says the Our Father, who says it better? Which one does God prefer? The point being, we're snowflakes. Yes? And again, I think it's the God's magnificence. Now, final thing to wrap up. As quickly as possible, I'm sure you have to go too. Over the course of the centuries, the question has been asked, are you right and we're wrong, or are we right and you're wrong? Is Jesus really the Messiah and we've got it wrong? Or Jesus, no. Why wouldn't we accept Jesus? Well, we looked at the world, and we can look at the world today and say, sorry, there's still warfare, bloodshed, suffering, disease, death. It's clear that God's reign of peace has not come. The answer to this question historically has been, you're right, and we're wrong. And we Jews suffered terribly for that answer. Thank God for Pope John the 23rd and Nostra Aetate. Thank God for wonderful Christian clergy like those who have served here at Westminster Church. And if I may, let me introduce you to Franz Rosenzweig. He was a Jew born in Kassel, Germany in 1885. Like many Jews of his day, he considered converting to Christianity, specifically to the Lutheran Church. Martin Luther thought that his Protestant Reformation would at last herald Jews accepting Jesus as the Messiah. We like being Jewish. We like being different. That's one of Judaism's great messages to the world. Because the truth is, we're snowflakes. We're all different. And it's to the magnificence of God that God can be worshipped in different ways. Okay. The night before he converted, he decided to make a last visit to the synagogue. And he had what I will call an epiphany. He realized he was Jewish through and through. He didn't convert. But the fact that he almost converted surely reflects his deep admiration and respect of Christianity. He fought for Germany in World War I. He was wounded in a gas attack, and the mustard gas scarred his lungs and ultimately would end his life about 10 or so years after World War I. But he devoted his final years to writing a book he called The Star of Redemption, and it's the only serious philosophical work that grapples with this question that I asked you. Are you right and we're wrong, or are we right and you're wrong? And here's his answer. Jesus is the Savior of Christians. Jews are waiting still for the Mashiach to come. Both are part of God's plan for the earth. I like that. That works for me. Every time I speak to a Christian group about this subject, I say this. I believe what you believe. I believe that Jesus is your Messiah. Lucky you. It's a gift. I don't know that you have a greater gift in your life. Okay? But as a Jew, I look at the world and I see suffering and warfare and bloodshed and disease, and I can't even watch a hockey game now for the cruelty. For the cruelty that I see on the ice. Yeah? Okay. And I say, no, the Mashiach hasn't come yet. But a final little anecdote. It's during the high holidays now, about 10 years ago, when I get an email from my friend and colleague, Rabbi Richard Agler, then the senior rabbi at Congregation B'nai Israel in Boca Raton. He writes to me the day after Rosh Hashanah. Mark, Rosh Hashanah night, I couldn't fall asleep. I decided to go downstairs and take a dip in the pool. Boca, nice. And I got as far as the sofa in the living room. And the next thing I know, I'm dozing on the sofa, and someone touches me on the shoulder, and I think that's either Mindy, his wife, or Elijah the prophet, the harbinger of the Mashiach. Next thing I know, I wake up in the morning, and I'm on the sofa. And I think about this last night, and I go upstairs, and I say, Mindy, did you come down and wake me up last night? She said, no. He writes to me, what do you make of this? And I said, if you thought it was Mindy or Elijah and it wasn't Mindy, then you know who it was. And if he touched you on the shoulder, then you know who you are. Now, what do I mean by this? Do you think Jesus walked around the Galilee thinking, hey, cool, I'm the Messiah. I don't think so at all. I think if anything, he had the uncanny ability to see God in everyone. Even his executioner. Yes? Forgive them, Lord, for they know not what they do. And we were talking about this last night. Yeah, okay. He turned to the thief on the cross next to him. Was it Barabbas? I thought Barabbas was set free. But he was crucified with two other men, yes? Yeah. A thief. An inveterate lifelong thief. And he turned to him and he said, You will be with me in heaven shortly. Yeah? Yeah. He was a heck of a guy, if you understand what I'm saying. And I mean with that with all due respect. I don't think he had any pretense or pomp about him. Now, what am I trying to say more deeply? Jewish tradition teaches one who saves a single soul, it is as if one has saved the entire universe. And one who destroys a single soul, it is as if one has destroyed an entire universe. Astrophysics teach us that we don't live in a universe, we live in a multiverse. And each and every one of us is at the center of one of those multiverses. And I think it's the obligation of everyone to do his and her best to try and save the universe that has been given to you. God bless you. You've got help. That's what Christianity is all about. So I'll stop here. I'm sorry, I don't have time for questions. God willing, if you'd like, we'll find time for me to come back one day. Thank you very much.